Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. This is our sixth Oscar podcast, and we're welcoming back Father Jim Martin and Bill McGarvey. Welcome you both.
Thanks, Tim.
Great to be here.
Good to see you.
Now we have nine movies to talk about here, so we're going to get started right away. And luckily we have Bill here because Bill has seen all nine of them. So congratulations, first
Thank
of all, to Bill.
Much. Thank you very much.
We're going to start with a movie that I think we've all seen, is Beasts of the Southern Wild. Bill, did you see this actually in the theaters? I saw this on my iPad. So
actually, I saw this with another Jesuit friend of mine, Dan Joyce in Philadelphia. One night we were watching, it was on demand, so I saw it on TV. I didn't see it on a screen. I have to admit, I thought it was an interesting. I think I'm more of a fan of the way the story about the film and the little girl and how the filmmakers did it on a very, very slim budget, et cetera. I thought it was a really well done movie. I don't think it's something that I would vote for in terms of best Oscar, best picture, but a well done movie and worth seeing. But it's fantastical movie and not without its problems. But I liked it.
Yeah, and for people who haven't seen it, it's the story of a young girl and a very young girl. What is she actually?
She's about seven in the movie, I think. Or
and,
six.
And her father, who live
in a bathtub in
Louisiana near New Orleans. Right. And it is one of the things I had a difficult time with. Is it, in fact, supposed to be about Katrina or not?
I agree. One of the things that I thought was funny about the whole thing was you're never really sure if this is about a real place. They call it the bathtub,
right.
And I think it's really not. I think it's supposed to be almost a fable about people living by the water, and it that was one of the frustrating things to me in some ways. Not that you have to geographically spike everything down into a place, but it was not necessarily situated in a post-Katrina world at all, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, I found it a little curious. I think my expectations were so high because it had gotten a nomination for Best Picture.
Yeah.
And I'd heard all these wonderful things about the young girl, Kuzavini, I guess her name is.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure if that's correct. But anyway, who was terrific.
Sure.
And so was the father, and so were all these untrained, unprofessional actors.
Yeah.
But I thought that the whole magical realism for me didn't work because it ends up that they go into kind of real scenes, you know, in hospitals, and you see refineries and things like that. And frankly, I just found it a little hard to follow. I didn't quite know what was going on. I didn't know there's a storm coming. Suddenly they're sort of flooded out.
Yeah.
She hangs around with all these people who are supposed to be charming and colorful, but I thought they were kind of lowlifes. I mean, they're basically drunk.
It was
and,
like Mad Max and Waterworld.
Well, yeah, and you're supposed to see them as, you know, primitive and elemental. And, you know, the relationship between her and her father was odd as well. So I wasn't a big fan. In between iPad and big screen, I saw it on my TV, and I found myself fast-forwarding just for the plot a couple times.
Yeah, I would agree. I think because the girl is a very riveting performance, I think there's a reason why, you know, it's gotten so much attention. But it's not a movie that I would run out. I was telling my friends to go run out and see.
And there are actually beasts in this movie. I mean, I was a little confused about that as well. Is there just these huge, what are they, wildebeest or something that she's...
And I guess the fantastical element is you're seeing it through a child's eyes, so that's that element.
Ah.
And it almost feels
like a
scriptural
story.
Biblical
in some
ways, Old Testament in some ways. But and on some levels, again, the story behind the story felt more interesting to me than the actual story.
Well, for some lighter fare, we can switch here to Amour, which, Bill, you have seen.
Yes,
we have not.
Okay, I get
Michael Haneke, who I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but I like his earlier films very much. Cash, is that how you pronounce it?
Cache is a great movie.
And then also The White Ribbon, which I liked a lot too.
Yes, I like that as well. Amour is definitely an upbeat, you know, children's movie. Don't take it is.
For those who don't know, this is about an aging couple.
I'm sorry, I really got to get to the program here. It's essentially, the story is a Parisian couple, and they're probably late 70s, early 80s, a very kind of upper middle class couple living, who'd been part of the arts world in Paris, and a very, very kind of high tone sort of couple. And the wife begins to enter into dementia. There's dementia going on and gradual. And it's very powerfully shot. It's a very powerful story. It's Haneke has a tendency to linger on images that are very difficult and powerful for a very long time. What fascinated me about the movie, and I don't want to give any spoilers away for it, it's not to say that it's certainly worth seeing, but what fascinated me, and I think it might be interesting to also America listeners and readers, is that I remember sitting there with a friend of mine and I said, honestly, this is what happened to my grandmother. This is dementia. And And it was fascinating to me to see all these folks who were crying and weeping in the theater. And I really, it struck me that I'm in a New York City theater, and I feel like within three blocks of here, there might be 30 to 50 people dealing with this very same reality.
Oh, at least.
Exactly. And, yeah. And the shock that seemed to register on these people's faces to actually see suffering, to actually look at it. And again, I don't want to give away the ending, but it, in that sense, it troubled me in some ways toward the end, and it bothered me in some of the conversations I had afterwards that sort of in the way people don't want to deal with the reality of suffering, the reality of death, the reality of the reality of what we really look like when we're dying and when we're falling apart.
I thought it was interesting also that the two actors, is it Jean-Louis Trintignant and Emmanuel Riva, both of them were very well known to art house fans. He was, I think, one of Truffaut's actors. And then she was in, I couldn't believe it, Hiroshima Mon Amour, which came out, gosh, I guess in the 60s or something. And so I think there's also, for film buffs, it's interesting to see these people who are, you know, actually old. I thought there was an interesting article recently about Judi Dench in Skyfall,
right,
and saying how unusual it is to see people who look old, you know, and are actually old in a mainstream movie. So I think part of it is just the physiognomy and just confronting people who don't look like you know, the beautiful young things that we normally see in movies.
Very true. It's a powerful movie, but we could write reams on it in American Magazine, I'm sure, about what the reality is, what this says about what we do as a culture and who we are.
Well, it sounds like a topic for our culture columnist, Bill McGarvey, who will be writing about some of these matters for us coming up. So please look out for that. We're going to switch to a movie now that we've all seen, Argo, which, as Bill was saying before, got passed over for Best Director, but seems to be gaining some steam here as we're heading towards the Oscars as a potential winner for the Best Picture.
I love this movie. I could not believe, like, yeah, I did. I don't think it's the best picture, but I was shocked that Ben Affleck got passed over. I didn't quite understand that. I mean, what do I know about the way the Academy votes? Right. But I found it riveting, and it was very taut. Even though one knows what's going to happen at the end, I mean, if you kind of read the summary, it had you on the edge of your seat. I thought he recreated the 1970s very well. I thought the cast was great. I mean, John Goodman and Alan Arkin and you know, Ben Affleck himself was pretty good. I thought not great. Mm-hmm. But, you know, between this and, what is it, Gone Baby Gone and The Town, I have to say, I used to think Ben Affleck was, just kind of a lug, basically, you know, when it came to his on-screen presence. But he's terrific. He's a great director. Who knew? I guess, you know, he's obviously a very bright guy. He spent time around all these, good filmmakers. So I really enjoyed it. It was made a little less palatable to me when I found out that some of the stuff actually didn't happen, that it wasn't quite so.
I went right to Wikipedia afterwards.
Yeah, it wasn't quite so dramatic.
Definitely.
I mean, they basically,
dramatic.
I mean, without giving too much away, they went in, they posed as filmmakers, they left. I mean, it was a little taut, but it wasn't as tense as the movie. Nonetheless, I liked it from start to finish.
And Gorilla Monsoon really wasn't in Iran at that time.
That's right. And I also liked Alan Arkin's line, who plays the sort of a filmmaker, and they're trying to come up with a fake film, and he says, if I'm going to make a fake film, it's going to be a fake hit. I thought that was one of the best lines of the year.
It's funny you say that, because I have to admit I'm with you on the Ben Affleck front, and unfortunately, unlike his partner in crime, Matt Damon, who sort of has taken a different route, I feel so, and it's a shame, because the saturation that Ben Affleck went through sort of in terms of the media with his relationships with Jennifer Lopez years ago and all this stuff, you really started to feel just a saturation point with the guy, and I really was turned off to him for a long time. I thought The Town was a really well-done movie. I'm not a fan of his on screen. I'm not a fan. It's hard for me to kind of get past the Affleckness of it, I liked the movie. I thought, I of course, often when I see these historical movies, I go back and sort of check it against what the reality was. And Jim's absolutely right that they took great liberties at the end. Understandably, from a filmmaker's point of view, why they'd want to do that to raise some suspense. But I thought it was a well done movie. He's clearly a really, really talented filmmaker. I wouldn't put it up for a best Oscar. But I do think it's funny that BAFTA and everybody else is giving him a Best Director's Award. It almost seems like they're really, I wonder if they're really sticking it to the Academy.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, the whole film is about making something, you know, telling a story to try to basically rescue these people out of Iran. So the whole question of whether this is true or not kind of plays into what the themes that the movie is exploring as well. But he's trying to have it both ways in a certain way, because he kind of wants to make it sort of like Zero Dark Thirty, this kind of documentary take on these events, to the point where at the end of the film you're seeing the actors next to juxtaposed with pictures of the real people. So you're thinking, oh, these are the real events, when in fact, as you said, they really took liberties with the plot. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, Lincoln, another movie we'll talk about, they certainly took liberties with some of the historical record there, and they're not getting nearly the kind of criticism.
Right, like the part where Lincoln goes to Iran and has to be spirited out on
Lincoln,
a Hercules
Lincoln on
transport
a motorcycle,
plane.
I thought was very improbable.
All right, we're going to switch now to a movie again that Bill has seen, Django Unchained.
This should be called Movies
I was
Bill
I was really wanted to see this one because I thought this would be interesting to talk about. We're going to talk about another Civil War era film, Lincoln, after this. But Bill, you've seen a lot of Tarantino films. How did this one stack up?
It's funny. The notion that it actually is a Civil War era film is funny because I hadn't thought about it. Because it's a Tarantino movie. And when you see Tarantino movies, you're entering into an alternate universe, which is Quentin Tarantino's universe. You know, and I think I've seen pretty much everything that Quentin Tarantino has done. And I think he's one of these auteur sort of directors that you go because you know what you're going, you know what he does. And I think once I saw Pulp Fiction, you know, what is it, 15 years ago, it was such a tour de force, I've sort of stayed with it. But I have to admit, you know, for a number of films now, he sort of has left me cold. I get the style, I get the point of view, I get the humor, the comic book, the cartoonishness of the characters. Django came out right on the heels of the Sandy Hook tragedy, pardon me. And so I will admit that I almost felt a slight level of guilt actually spending money to see this movie because, as Tarantino often does, it's a bloodbath in there, you know. There's a lot of controversy around how often he used the N-word and all these things. But this is what Tarantino does. He's a provocateur. But ultimately, it's like cotton candy. It goes down. It's sweet and it's fun.
But let me ask you, because I admire him as a director. I do think his films are too violent, and I'm curious what you think about this. I mean, in a movie like Django Unchained, what is the point of so much violence? I mean, it is cartoonish, but, I mean, does it really contribute to the movie?
I don't think that's a great point. I think my sense of today, I don't dare, you know, sort of answer in his name, but he's a filmmaker that came up. My nephew, Robert, who's an enormous film buff, and I think I saw the movie with him afterward, he said he read a book on directors that said that filmmakers like the Coen brothers and Quentin Tarantino are in love with films, and they know far more about films than they know about real life. And so that's why their films have a sort of cartoonish quality. And I think there's some real truth to that.
Yeah, but there are a lot of people, there are a lot of directors who are, you know, film
Wes
buffs.
Anderson.
Who have different styles. I think that what I found kind of surprising is there was an interview, I think in Entertainment Weekly or something, where they asked him, in light of Newtown, they had a kind of symposium of television writers and screenwriters and all this, asking about violence, which I think is a really important question in the culture today. And he refused. He's like, I'm not going to talk about that. And I thought, you know what? If you're making films that are violent, and, you know, fine, that's an artistic choice, at least have the guts to say, you know, this is why I'm doing it, and I don't think it contributes to violence in the culture. But I found it, reading about Django Unchained and looking at all, you know, there's a movie that came out called Bullet to the Head.
Right.
I thought, there is no way, let me put it this way, it doesn't help too much.
No.
Right? So I'm just curious, does it fit in the sort of milieu of the movie? Does it make sense, or does it seem kind of outlandish?
No, I don't think, again, if you're talking about a comic book, which Tarantino movies always seem to me to be, they're comments on, they're commentaries on films. You know, they're not even commentary on narrative. They're on a very sort of specific kind of narrative, which is film / cartoons almost to a comic book level. The thing that frustrates me about it is, no, of course it's not necessary. I can't think of many times that he's had things that were completely necessary. But to say they're necessary to a plot, I'm not so sure you could. What's the plot of Pulp Fiction, you know, or Jackie Brown? The plots are thin excuses to get a bunch of interesting characters or very sort of outlandish, overly drawn characters to interact. What's frustrating to me about Tarantino is a guy that clearly knows film inside and out, has studied it. At 50 or whatever, you want him to grow up and deal with some more adult themes at a certain level, at a certain point for me, because I think he is a very talented filmmaker, and I kind of often find that, geez, he's stuck in the graphic novel.
Although some of, you know, major critics, including Frank Rich, there was a cover story in New York Magazine saying he thought this was the best film of the year, in part because Tarantino was actually trying to gauge with this historical reality, and he tried to do it in a very creative way. And compared to Lincoln, which is a more kind of traditional treatment of, you know, the subject of race and slavery.
Frank Rich has got his, I don't know where his head is at. I don't agree with him at all. I think Frank Rich is struggling mightily to make a case for that. And Tarantino, we know what Tarantino does. I think he's very talented at what he does. He's a very clear. You see a Tarantino movie, you know immediately, like in the same way that you hear Paul McCartney's voice, you know that who that is. But the notion that somehow it's this really sort of, you know, edgy sort of take or narrative, I don't buy it at all.
Well, Bill doesn't buy it. Frank, well, I'm sure another critic, A.O. Scott, thought that Lincoln and Django Unchained would make a very interesting double feature.
Double feature? It would be a very long double feature. You better pack a lunch for that.
Well, I will give my quick take on Lincoln. I was surprised how much I liked it. I mean, I saw it a long time after it came out. I read a lot of the reviews. I'm not a huge Spielberg fan, especially when he takes on historical material, but this felt...
Really? Schindler's List you didn't like?
I'm thinking more of like Amistad and some of those films,
right,
which
okay,
I thought were sort of overdone. But but this was more understated, and maybe it was just the power of Daniel Day-Lewis's performance that I kind of forgot that I was watching a Spielberg film, but I really liked it.
I loved it. It wasn't perfect. I mean, I'm no director, but I thought, you know what? There are a couple scenes that you could easily cut. The scene at the beginning, this is not ruining anything, where these two soldiers, African-American soldiers, come up and quote the Gettysburg Address from memory. I thought, give me a break. You know, and there was no need for that. There was no need for this kind of schmaltz. But then, you know, you look at something like Saving Private Ryan. That was very schmaltzy, you know, at parts. And yet there are these parts, you know, the middle, you know, is just spectacular. So I thought Daniel Day-Lewis was amazing. I mean, at one point I got chills thinking, like, it's like I'm watching Abraham Lincoln. I'm in his presence. Mm-hmm. So he was superb, and all the stories about how he kept in character, I thought it was kind of funny. There was a guy from Mad Men, what's his name, Jared Harris, I think, who said that he was talking about Mad Men with Daniel Day-Lewis while Daniel Day-Lewis was in character.
Really?
You know, and what do you think, Mr. President of Mad Men? I thought Sally Field was great. I really like her as an actress. I thought she was great as Mary Todd Lincoln. I thought there was a little bit, there was an interesting column in the Times, I think, the New York Times, talked about the three sort of vote fixers, James Spader and Tim Blake Nelson, and a third guy who John Hawkes, yeah.
Right. Oh, and he was great in the Sessions.
Yeah, yeah.
Overlooked.
Yeah, and, you know, I thought it was interesting until I read that article, which basically says, oh, they're kind of portrayed as these scamps, and they're, you know, they're basically kind of like buying votes. I thought the idea that, you know, you had to compromise was interesting. I thought, what's his name, Tommy Lee Jones was terrific. So all in all, really good. But it was one of those movies where I thought, you know, look, just cut those two scenes, cut the scenes at the beginning and at the end, you know, he's walking off in the distance, and it would have been much tighter. And I sometimes, that does bother me about Spielberg. But if Daniel Day-Lewis doesn't win that, he should unleash Django Unchained on everybody in the Academy.
Jimbo Unchained and Jim Martin. I agree with, I think, everything you've all said. I think for me, Daniel Day-Lewis, again, maybe it's a function in the same, the Ben Affleck syndrome, the function that he works so little that when he does work, it really, the impact is really great. And he takes, and the roles he takes are great, and also the way he executes the roles are amazing. I would agree with what Jim said about the opening scene. It can be a little, it's definitely, you feel like, okay, here are my heartstrings. Where are you going to tug them? That said, it's a phenomenal performance. I you know, what interested me the most is somebody, I hadn't read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, but what amazed me sort of more than anything was what a politician Lincoln was, which of course I should have known, but to see it on its face, to see a man who clearly understood the game he was in and what it was going to take to pass this amendment, and how he didn't get dirty in the way that, in the classic way, but he definitely went into the political mud a bit there's a little ends justifying the means sort of dynamic happening there. Wonderfully done. It's hard. I mean, it would be, to screw that up would have been a huge problem. So I think the fact that he was teed up with a great subject, probably what's considered to be the greatest American president in history, with one of the great actors of all time, I think he did a great job with it. And I agree that at some point you really felt like I'm watching film footage of Lincoln. So really, really well done.
Now, I read the book shortly after seeing the film, and it's only based on one chapter in the book, which is interesting.
Is it like that?
It's
little?
It's just one short chapter, and it is. They certainly do take liberties. There is something about the fact that she wrote this book and did this research that really does inform Lewis's performance, and it really makes the film richer. Although it's only based on this slice of history.
It's like a procedural drama is what it is.
Right,
really.
It's this slice of history. Yeah. But his performance in particular about who Lincoln was and his political genius, I think, draws a lot from her portrait.
Does it? Okay.
And that's what I came away from this book was, God, this guy was like had this amazing emotional intelligence, was able to kind of bring these people together, know when to kind of stroke their egos, know when he had to take a stand. It was, it's very well done.
And it's fine because I have to admit, Doris Kearns Goodman is one of those people that often drives me nuts. She's like the infotainment.
Oh, heaven forbid. How could you say that about Doris Kearns Goodman?
I'm sorry. What does Doris Kearns, what does she think about baseball? What does she think about badminton? It's just like she seems to be available only under any circumstances.
I will hear no bad things about Doris
Kearns Goodman. She's a wonderful scholar. She's a bit of a gadfly, but anyway. But I thought it was a wonderful film.
I thought it was pretty clever that they, from having taken one chapter, they changed the cover of the book to, you know, it said something like, based in part on this book. I thought that's pretty good, too. I was surprised Abraham Lincoln was tall. I had no idea before.
Well, his voice is the big
thing,
right?
That's right.
It has a high voice.
Which apparently was accurate because it carried so well. But, yeah, it was just terrific.
But tell me real quick, what were the – I mean, interestingly, not that we don't want to get any spoilers, but what were the historical distortions going on? Anything significant that we should be –
There wasn't as much about these vote fixers, as I recall,
from
the book. There's a little bit about that, but they make it into something more of a drama, where my understanding is what the Republicans, for example, there was in the movie they portray the split among the Republicans. I guess they were more united than the film makes them out to be.
So Tommy Lee Jones' character is clearly the guy that is a principled man who...
Yeah, they mention him in the book.
No horse trading at all. Right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. Yeah. Next book, Life of Pi, next film and book. We reviewed this. Karen Smith reviewed it for us, but Bill again has seen this film. So, did you like it? It plays with questions of faith. So,
very much so.
It would be of very interest to our listeners.
Absolutely, I think America readers would like it. It might not be possible by the time you listen to this podcast, but I would. It's one of the few films that I would say it's actually worth seeing it in 3D. I'd say this and Avatar were the two films I can imagine ever, and I'm not a fan of 3D, but seeing it on a big screen in 3D, it's visually very stunning. Ang Lee has a beautiful, you know, artistic sort of sensibility in terms of the films he makes often and the way he shoots.
And I hear it was also not showy. Someone said that the 3D is not showy. It's not.
No, not at all. No, it never feels like a huge
like things
gimmick.
Being thrown at the screen.
No, it
right?
never feels like it's. You never feel like you're in a special effects house. You just feel like you're into and you're more deeply into the story. It is an interesting story. To be honest, I had not read the book, and I have friends who loved the book, so I was looking forward to see it. It certainly wrestles with the issue of faith, I would say, and it's beautifully and powerfully made. I would say at the end it was frustrating to me in the way what had been built up in terms of this story of faith and what this parable was going to be about, essentially.
The book's like that, too.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a little kind of thin gruel.
At the end, I felt like that's...
Right.
I felt like, really? Okay, I thought there'd be a little bit more of a bang for the buck here at the end. I think just in the sense of where culture is at in terms of conversations about religion and faith, Life of Pi is probably a good weather vane for the level of some of these conversations, which America Magazine readers might find to be, as you said, Jim, thin. And yet I think it's probably indicative of some of the conversations and in a way that it takes faith in cultural terms currently seriously.
Well, this next film, I'm going to shut up and let these two Philadelphia natives talk about Silver Linings Playbook. Which takes place, is it in Philly or outside Philly?
It takes place near Upper Darby, I would say, which is, for the record, that my cousin, Mary Beth, had her house sort of location scouted for this because it takes place right near where she lives and where my father grew up. So Bill and I have been talking about this. It's a Philadelphia movie, and a friend of mine from Philly said that... much of the talk in Philadelphia is like, you know, who has the most connections to Silver Linings Playbook?
It is. It's funny.
In terms of like the high schools like Bonner and Prendergast.
Exactly.
And it was kind of shocking how much it's, you know, you can see it as, I mean, it's almost like any town USA because it's not right in the heart of Philly. There are some things that people would recognize, like the Benjamin Franklin Hotel and, you know, the Eagles games, things like that. But if you're from that area, there are some, you know, interesting comments. I went into it. I think this is one of the reasons that they shouldn't have 9 or 10 nominations. I went into it, you know, thinking it was going to be the greatest thing on earth. I thought it was compelling, well acted. I thought Bradley Cooper was good, even though he's supposed to be this schlub, which I found ridiculous.
Yeah.
Jennifer Lawrence, who had been in Hunger Games, I thought was interesting because she's playing an adult and she's kind of a young, youngish woman or an adolescent in Hunger Games. Right. One of the big surprises was Robert De Niro, for once, does not phone in the performance. You know, he's not, you know, Meet the Fockers or, you know, playing a riff on, you know, like a Goodfellas type character. Right. I thought it was a really interesting performance by him. I found it very compelling. I thought the story, I mean, the story is about two sort of, shall we say, I guess bipolar or mentally challenged or people with psychological
emotional issues,
psychological difficulties coming together. A little unrealistic for my taste, but funny and compelling. And the other thing I must say is that apparently no one knows how to do a Philadelphia accent. I was really... Now, Bradley Cooper grew up, I know, I think in Upper Derby around there.
No, he grew up in Jenkintown.
Jenkintown, okay, there we go. So, like, Philly battles right here.
Went to Georgetown, too.
Okay. But, you know, like, Robert... One of the things that really ticked me off... All right, Friday, Robert De Niro is Robert De Niro. He speaks like Robert De Niro. Jackie Weaver, who's an Australian. Okay, pretty good.
She did a good...
His friend, Frankie or Paulie or whatever, right. Sounds like he's from Brooklyn.
Yeah, Brooklyn.
And so every movie that takes place in Philadelphia, now they get the Baltimore accent right, but every movie that takes place in Philadelphia, they just can't get it right. The only time I thought it was good was when Frankie says, like, oh, that's beautiful. And I thought that's pretty good. But then at the end it says dialogue coach, and I said, you know, fire her, basically. What did you think?
I saw your Facebook post right after. I think I had – a movie like that because I knew what it was about. I mean, to be – that movie was filmed essentially a mile from where I grew up and where my parents still live in Upper Darby. And that there's a big scene at the Lanark Diner there, which so I can tell you for a fact I've been going to since I was born. And my parents in the 80s were in two episodes there where there was actual gunplay at the Lanark Diner. What's hilarious? Go ahead.
My parents were engaged at the Benjamin Franklin Hotel.
Really?
So I'm just one-upping you a little bit.
The hilarious thing about
I'm impressed you can say most people can't say the Lanark Diner.
They can't.
It's, you know, it's spelled with like three L's.
It is like three L's, you know? And it's like it must be the Native American spelling. But the but the funny thing was about the great. So this movie took place. Most of it took place within 2 miles of where I grew up, literally. And I drove by all these places just a week or two ago. And the funny thing is, I was at the Lanark Diner a week and a half ago, and this is a place you'd think this is an internationally well-known, beloved movie. And I think they'd be taking advantage. I was in there like, hey, so you getting a lot of business since the movie? And they go, oh, what movie? And I'm like, are you kidding me? They're not taking advantage of the way they could. It's very Philadelphia. It's very Philadelphia. I disagree with you about that. I thought the accents were fine. People always tell me I look like Bradley Cooper, so I'm always interested in hearing that.
Are these blind people? Or
why are you laughing?
People who have ever seen Bradley Cooper?
No, I thought, honestly, I've seen it and I actually went back and took my nephew, who's a big film buff, and he's just out of college, and I was amazed at the second time seeing it how much Jennifer Lawrence is an enormous part of why this movie works so well. She's great. She's really great. And she's beautiful, but not in a way that you find like you're
And she's very young. Isn't she 22, 23?
She's 22
Which is strange because she's supposed to be kind of a peer of Bradley Cooper, right?
But I think they do a good job of it. It's believable. I think, honestly, this would be, you know, my favorite movie of the year. It's a small movie. I'm surprised. I think there wasn't a lot of hype for me before I went. I think I went the weekend it came out. And so I kind of saw it on my own terms. And I think... given my taste, it's a smaller sort of movie. I thought De Niro was great. I agree. I would disagree that Meet the Fockers or Meet the Parents is, I mean, it's not Taxi Driver by a long shot.
No, but it's the same. He plays the same kind of blowhard New York character. By the way, big shout out to John Ortiz, fellow Labyrinth Theater Company member,
who was great.
Hysterical. Where he's talking about how he feels choked by his job and
sort his wife.
That was terrific. But the other thing is, it's based on a book, isn't it? Isn't
it based on a book? Yeah, by Matthew Quick, LaSalle University grad. And my
there
sister works at LaSalle, so I
there
should
you
do
go. There.
Yeah, exactly.
Another one up. By the way, Lanark is Welsh. It's one of those Welsh names, just sort of one up each other. It's not Lenny Lenape. But, you know, I thought also a creative story for once. I mean, this is not a story that you expect. It was very hard to see what was coming. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of sad moments, you know, when the Bradley Cooper character kind of, you know, fails in what he's trying to do. But, you know, creative. And it really, as my mother always says, kept my interest, you know, which
is
a big plus.
I thought it was a really well-done movie. I disagree. I think the Philly accents were done relatively well. It wasn't, you know, you don't want it to be too heavy duty, but I think you're right. De Niro's friend in the movie, his bookie friend, is not exactly, he's not, he didn't travel far from Brooklyn to do this role.
Well, when they make a movie about Riverdale, you guys can listen to me talk about it for 15
for hours.
Minutes. Yeah, exactly.
Sorry. Cut that down, Tim. You can edit all that down.
Don't edit one word.
Well, a bit of a historical jump to Les Mis, which is the next film. I'm familiar with this film as a cultural phenomenon. I saw it on Broadway, but I have not actually seen the film. Bill, what was your take? There seemed to be a polarizing. People either loved it or really, the critics didn't like it at all.
It's funny. I have to admit, this is the last movie I saw, and I only saw it last week because we were doing this podcast, and I probably should have, considering the incompleteness of my panelists, my opposition on this.
I saw the trailer.
Exactly.
You know.
To be honest, I was not looking forward to seeing this movie. I'd seen the play 20 years ago on Broadway. And what I got to tell you, I was very, very surprised. I found it very moving. I am not generally a big musical fan. And what was amazing to me, which surprised me is having seen the play, was I clearly did not understand the story very well. And what a film does.
Backstory or the.
Jim's looking. I think what the film allowed for somebody like me, you know, I saw it when I was much younger and perhaps just not as perceptive, but I had no idea of the scope of time, the epic tale, and who the characters were and where they went in the play as much as in the movie, the film. It's just very clearly done. Mm-hmm. So on a very simple level, I think you were talking earlier about one of the films, which you did, Beasts of the Southern Wild, but you almost couldn't follow if there was a plot. I followed this so much better and was much more moved by it. I know a lot of people have taken people to task on it. I am actually not a huge Anne Hathaway fan. I find myself always thinking that's Anne Hathaway. And I know people have criticized Russell Crowe, but I thought he did a good
job. How was his voice? Someone told me his voice was not that great.
Maybe I was just so surprised, but I was very moved by this film. Honestly, I had forgotten or didn't care or just didn't know how deeply Christian the film is. Hugo was not, I think, a fan of the Catholic Church, but the church, wrestling with faith and wrestling with, love versus the law are enormous themes in this.
We have a great article by, is it Charles Klamak? Is that his name? On how reading Les Miserables, helped him in his vocation as a priest because he was so taken with the character of the bishop, from whom Jean Valjean steals the candlesticks and the bishop forgives him.
Yeah.
So even though, now you were saying you understood it more. Do you mean than the when you saw the musical on stage?
I'd never read, and of course, like I do, I went on Wikipedia after this, and sorry.
And read Les Miserables online.
It's Les Miserables. You don't pronounce the L-E.
It's pronounced Lanark.
Lanark. And of course, Hugo didn't write the music.
The music, right.
It wasn't deliberate. That's right. Of course, it's a 2,000-page novel with tremendous enormous digressions, very French. But so I did go. But no, I think I followed because it was a film and because things were laid out in ways, visually that couldn't be done on stage. I think I just followed it better and therefore liked it more. And honestly, I was very moved by it. And surprisingly so. It would not be my favorite film of the year, but I was very pleasantly surprised because I was expecting to not like this at all.
Now, there are people who are Broadway fans who are not big fans of this score. Now, you're a musician. Do you like the music?
I thought the Broadway. No, really? There's a big critique of it? Oh, geez, I should have read it.
There are people, for example, our critic, Michael Tuwith, a huge Broadway person.
Michael
doesn't
Tuwith.
Let you know, Mike.
I have a bone.
Father Michael Tuwith. Not a big fan of this show. So there are people out there who feel like maybe it's a little, I don't know, treacly.
And he's a fan of the play.
A lot of people find it very bombastic, right? Just kind of in your face and overly dramatic and. That's the critique I had heard, and that some of the people, I think they critique that the sort of extreme close-up that they apparently do in the movie of everyone singing like that.
I'm sure if I went back and you could say, geez, Russell Crowe, his voice is not perfect, Hugh Jackman, but I honestly really, really liked it a lot. I thought it was very moving. It was well done.
Now we're going to end with what is probably the most controversial film of the year, Zero Dark Thirty, which I did say I think we've all seen it. I will just say I was pretty disturbed by the first half hour, 45 minutes, when they document the torture that went on. This is a film, as you know, about the hunt for bin Laden, and takes place over a 10-year period, starting roughly with 9/11 and the kind of interrogations that happened in the years that followed. But as I thought, as a piece of directing, especially the last 45 minutes of the film, it was really masterful. I mean, I was literally sitting on the edge of my seat. I don't think I ever do that in a movie theater. Bill, what was your...
I would agree. I think my first thought on the movie was... who outside of the United States would care about this movie, because I'm not so sure a lot of people will necessarily. I mean, the notion of it's getting, what, 98% on Rotten Tomatoes positive feedback, I thought, well, I really thought it was a well-done movie, and I agree the last 40 minutes are riveting.
Which were tacked on, apparently.
Really?
After, yeah, because they were, had been Catherine Bigelow, the director, had been planning on making this movie about, you know, the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and the killing of Osama bin Laden happened as they were filming the movie. So in a sense, this is because they had to make kind of an extra movie.
I thought it was it happened while they were writing the movie. And they had to really scrap the writing.
I don't know.
But it's I would say the last 40 minutes are riveting. The thing about Bigelow's directing is, and I felt this way about The Hurt Locker, there's something incredibly blank about her directorial style. There is no moral conscience behind it. It seems to me she is almost a reporter in some ways.
Or a documentarian.
A documentarian, very much so.
She's trying, I think, even visually it looks like that.
Visually, not, it's very flat. And that works, I think, I think it has a great effect in these movies. Honestly, it was strange, and I will admit to the fact that in the last 40 minutes, which is essentially the raid on bin Laden's compound, the little child in me who wanted to be a Marine came out, like, thinking, man, these guys, this was like a surgical strike, and these SEAL Team 6 people are just these, you know, as somebody who's spent, you know, enough time with the Catholic Worker and reading Dorothy Day about pacifism and having great affection for that.
This would not be Dorothy Day's favorite
movie.
No,
it wouldn't be. But the part of me that was just amazed at how talented and how well trained and how effective these warriors are really struck me. It was a very much a surgical strike, the way that it was portrayed,
and yet flawed. I mean, with the helicopter crashing.
Absolutely.
It's funny. I mean, I'm glad we're talking about this. It's probably the movie that sort of raises the most moral questions, I think. Like Tim, interestingly, Tim, I was prepared for much worse in the torture. Mm-hmm. I was prepared for a sort of physical. I have a sort of low tolerance for people being in pain, things like that. Mm-hmm. So I was prepared for much worse, and I was able to watch it. You know, I mean, it wasn't as if I'd turned my eyes away. I was so frustrated, though. I think Catherine Bigelow is just a genius. I thought Hurt Locker was spectacular. I thought Point Break, you know, all those years ago, in terms of visually, which was really well done. So I'm a big fan of hers. And yet, you know, she does leave the viewer with the idea that this torture, you know, ended up giving the United States government the information it needed to find bin Laden, which apparently was, you know, is not accurate. And so in a sense, on the one hand, as Tim was saying, it is sort of repellent, the torture. On the other hand, you know, logically, you come out thinking, oh, okay, well, it, you know, got some information, so therefore it's okay. So that bothered me a lot, and I wish that she didn't have to do that. I mean, I wish she could have, if she's trying to be a documentarian, why not show that they tortured people and they got the information in another way, perhaps. So, but on the other hand, it's anyway. So, but as a movie, I mean, I thought it was brilliant. Yeah. I mean, as a movie and sort of presenting those kinds of things, it was brilliant. I found, I thought the whole thing was sort of riveting. The Jessica Chastain character, who I thought was a little bit of a cipher. I mean, it's not until the end she cries. A lot of people, now here's where Tim can jump back in. A lot of people compare it to Homeland. Right. You know, is it Showtime or HBO? Okay. Showtime, the Showtime series. Claire Danes and her character, who's kind of, you know, monomaniacal in her hunt for Abu Nazir, you know, which is a kind of bin Laden, you know, sort of a stand-in. Jessica Chastain, who is great, was great in The Tree of Life. She's just really terrific. Yeah. But in the end, it kind of did disturb me that she's a little bit of a cipher. We don't get to know her too much, and she's based apparently on a real character. But nonetheless,
I thought she was an amalgam of characters. And I feel that way about the past two Bigelow films I've seen. That I don't think the characters amount.
Well, that's true.
It's very plot driven.
Yeah.
It's very story driven.
Yeah, yeah, and they are you think about it, and like the Jeremy Renner character is kind of a cipher. I think probably you're right. What worked against her was this controversy about the torture. But as a film, it was riveting.
No, I mean, it really. I thought, and I was saying this last night in a discussion, I thought it was more ambiguous. I mean, clearly, I would say the guy who played, I forget his name, the CIA, Dan, I thought it was a great character. I thought he did an amazing job. I think his name is Clark.
Yes.
He was great, but it was also very troubling to see, boy, this is an analyst's job in the CIA, which is to extract information. I thought, however, given all that and as powerful and as disturbing as a lot of that is, I thought that it was never the clear connection was never truly made that information extracted while using enhanced interrogation techniques, the euphemism for waterboarding, et cetera. I thought it was never clear that that was there was a direct line. I really have to see the movie again to see that there clearly it was definitely shown and displayed in the movie. Whether I thought I'm not clear enough. It was a long film again. Did it actually draw that direct line?
Yeah, I mean, I read right afterwards this essay in the New York Review of Books, and I'm forgetting the author's name, but he makes a pretty damning case that when you look at the film as a whole. For example, when she's looking at the various films of the interrogations and connecting the dots, trying to figure out who this courier is, in most of those cases, it looks like those people had been tortured or at least abused in some way. So it's hard. She's saying it's more ambiguous. That's what Bigelow herself has said, is that she's interested in the ambiguity. But it's hard not to agree with people like, I think, John McCain, and there was somebody else from Congress who said, Dianne Feinstein basically said, there's a problem here because this is going to basically inform the historical record. People are going to think this is true.
Well, I also think one of the things that disturbed me, I mean, as much as I admire Catherine Bigelow, was she had a very strange op-ed piece, I think, in the LA Times or something, where she basically said something like, you know, I'm taking kind of artistic liberties. And I thought, well, no, wait, look, if you're saying you're making kind of an accurate, you know, sort of blow-by-blow representation of what's going on, which is what it's presented as, right?
It feels documentary.
It does. And then say, well, I've kind of, you know, compressed things, particularly with an issue, as Tim was saying, that's so incendiary, you know. That's the part that, you know, it's the same with the Steven Spielberg thing. I think like all of us, we kind of play director, like I would have done it differently. I would have said to Spielberg, leave those two scenes. I would have said to the guy who directed Beasts of the Southern Wild, like a little more clarity, please. And I would have said to Catherine Bigelow, like just make it a little more accurate and make it more ambiguous about where they might have gotten this information.
And it's amazing to me that she isn't more sensitized to the issue of torture because she was married to James Cameron for at least 3 years.
Yeah, that's right. So
and
they
so
say.
So she is clearly practice of torture.
Give Tina Fey or is it Amy Poehler credit for that
was
joke.
That her joke?
Yes, that was her joke.
Didn't
so.
I change it a little bit?
Well,
ask Bradley Cooper.
I want to thank both of you for taking
part.
Wait,
we haven't picked.
You want to pick, sorry. So we're going to go into what our picks are, okay? We're going to talk quickly about what our picks for Best Picture are. I think Lincoln's going to take it. Father Jim, what do you think?
Best Picture, I think it's going to be Lincoln, and I'm not sure what it should be. It probably should be Lincoln. I think that edges out Zero Dark Thirty just a little bit.
I would agree that Lincoln will be best film. It's not my favorite film, as I said before. The Silver Linings was my favorite film of the year. Daniel Day-Lewis has to win for leading actor.
Oh, wait, we're doing leading actor now?
Well, I'm just jumping on. I want to do, in terms of, I wish that The Master, we never talked about it. I really wish Joaquin Phoenix did a great job in that, and some of the shots in that. I think it's a movie we're going to be talking about for a number of years. The biggest oversight, I would say, is John Hawkes not getting nominated for The Session.
He's really very
which
good.
Which is really a great movie and a really well-done character.
All right. I think actor in a leading role will be Daniel Day-Lewis. Actor in a supporting role will probably be Robert De Niro because he hasn't gotten one in a while. I think actress in a leading role, I think it's going to work against Jessica Chastain, that she's in that movie. I think Jennifer Lawrence is too young. I think the other woman is, too old. I think Kuvajane Wallace is too young. Naomi Watts, I don't think anybody saw The Impossible. I actually think that Emmanuel Riva has a shot because, she's kind of the darling.
Hathaway.
Yeah, and also the Academy, I think, likes to show, oh, look how sophisticated we are. We're voting for this 85-year-old French woman. And I bet Anne Hathaway walks away with it.
And
even though I think Sally Field should win for supporting.
She's already won twice. But I will say that Flight with Denzel Washington is underrepresented. I thought it was a really, really well-done film, and Denzel did a great job on that.
Yeah, I think a very strong year for films. One of our bloggers said that Flight is a great movie with the message of redemption.
Yeah.
And something that people,
really,
and I think
well
it's now on DVD, so you should go out and see it. Yeah. So, well, I want to thank Bill McGarvey and Father Jim Martin for joining us for this podcast, and we'll
thank
look
you.
Forward to next year.
Thank you.
My pleasure. See you at the movies.
See ya.